We're back in Mark's Gospel again. We've got a lot to get through this evening, actually. It's quite overwhelming. You remember Mark's Gospel, don't you? It's the account of Jesus' life that was written to those practical ancients, the Romans. It's not like Luke's Gospel, which is a scholarly account. It's not like Matthew's Gospel, which is a Jewish Gospel. It's not like John's Gospel, the spiritual Gospel. It's written to the Romans. It's not full of meticulous details or theology or anything like that. They want to know, what did Jesus do? And that is what Mark majors on. And it's striking as you read Mark's Gospel, how Mark, he just flips from one thing to the other. Jesus went here, Jesus did that, Jesus said this, Jesus healed this person. Because John Mark was sensitive to the people that he was writing to. Just like we should be sensitive to the people in our culture, their presuppositions, their ideas, their values. We should be just like John Mark was in that sense. And to do anything else is to actually misrepresent God himself. I think sometimes we can think, if we just feed the right theology to people, then all will be well. But actually, in doing that, we're misrepresenting God. It's bad theology because God himself has given us four different gospels, four different accounts of Jesus' life tailored for different people. And most recently from Mark 7, we saw about the Pharisees and their kind of OCD ritualistic washings that they did. I find that to be a particularly funny account. Jesus certainly doesn't beat around the bush, does he, of what he talks about. I mean, he basically says to the Pharisees, you may be so into all this ritualistic washing of pots and cups and hands and all the rest of it, but next time you go to the toilet, have a look, and you'll see that your feces are as yucky as the next bloke's. So, yeah, that's what he said, not me. I like that story. I find it so funny. You know, I used to wonder, seriously, I really did used to wonder, why did God make us to function in that particular way in the first place? I mean, he could have made the human body so efficient that there's no waste produced as a byproduct. But just think about all the illustrative material and humour that would be missed if that had been the case. I'm sorry, I know I'm not preaching Mark 7 tonight, but I just couldn't resist. And I'm not really one to laugh because I'm totally OCD when it comes to hand washing. But that's for hygiene reasons, not ritualistic reasons, which is not what Jesus is talking about at all. Because Jesus there, he's talking about the fact that it's what's in our hearts that is the problem. The Pharisees thought that through religion, through changing the outward, that's what made us acceptable to God and that's what makes us good people. But Jesus turns that around altogether and says, actually, the problem starts from within each of us. It's not outside. The problem is inside. The problem is in our hearts. The problem is that the default setting is that we're bad as people. It's a completely radical way of thinking in that day and age, and it's completely radical today as well to say that the default setting, the starting point, is that our hearts are bad. That's why we do bad things. It's not because of what's outside of us, and that our hearts need to change. But we've seen a whole load of other things happen in Mark's Gospel. We've seen Jesus walking on water. People have been healed. People are being delivered from demons. There's all sorts of miracles that are going on. But Mark's writing very much with an agenda. He wants us to see who Jesus really is and that we can believe in him and that we can trust in him today. And what Mark really majors on is the human aspect of Jesus, that Jesus is really human. You see Jesus' human emotions, as it were. You see his limitations. Jesus gets hungry. Jesus gets tired. And yet, Jesus has power over sickness, over death, over demons, and even over sin, where he forgives people's sins. Jesus has only the power, throughout the rest of the entire Bible, the whole Old Testament, all those things are only ever attributed to God himself, showing us that Jesus is man. He truly is a man. He's completely a man. And yet at the same time, Jesus is 100% God. But Jesus, despite all these things that he's doing, is finding that opposition is starting to mount. And the source of this opposition is, of course, the religious powers of the day, the Pharisees themselves. So we're picking up the story in verse 24 of chapter 7 tonight. And we'll start there, verse 24. The Syrophoenician woman. And Jesus, he moves on to Tyre and Sidon. These are places that weren't particularly Jewish. They're not Jewish hangouts at all. He's moving from Golders Green, he's going to Brixton. Jesus is probably feeling under pressure from the opposition that he's getting from the Pharisees, and he needs to have a break. Jesus goes to Tyre and Sidon, but he's not going there to do ministry, as we see in verse 24. He entered a house he didn't want anybody to know, but wanted to be hidden. He's probably really feeling that pressure by this point, and he needs a break. We saw this last time, didn't we, when we looked at Mark chapter 4, that Jesus, being human, gets tired, needs to have a rest. And just to reiterate, if you need a break, if you've been working hard, if you're finding life difficult, it's okay to have a break. But you might not necessarily get one, because Jesus didn't. The peace and quiet doesn't last very long. Jesus, his fame is spread throughout the whole of Palestine. He's doing all these things. People are hearing about the healings that are going on, the fact that people are being delivered from demons. And so this woman comes to Jesus, and she has a problem. What's the problem? Her little girl, we're told, has an unclean spirit. A demon. Are there such a thing as demons? Yes. Can somebody be demon-possessed? Yes. Jesus doesn't say to this woman now, listen, dear, your girl isn't really possessed by a demon. With the right teaching and the right understanding, she'll be as right as rain. No, this girl was actually being attacked by a real spiritual being. And the Bible just assumes that this is a reality. He healed people because they were sick. He fed many because people got hungry and they needed to eat. He cast demons out of people because people became demon-possessed. And this is a point of much contention amongst Christians today. Can somebody be demon-possessed? Should we be ministering to people in this way like Jesus does? I'm no expert, but Mark in his gospel has this amazing kind of balance. Sometimes the demonic activity is just that people are rejecting Jesus. The Pharisees, in their behavior, that's demonic. But sometimes people are actually attacked and possessed by demons. We saw this before when we looked at Mark chapter 4. We saw the guy who was possessed by a demon there as well. Sometimes people really are inhabited and possessed by demons to the point where they are no longer over control over themselves anymore. I've heard it split into two different categories. I've renamed them normal demonic and abnormal demonic. Normal demonic, false doctrine, false teachers, just plain old sin. The source of all those things is actually demonic. It's Satan himself. It's causing those things to happen. But those are kind of normal, everyday things that we'd expect to see just in normal, everyday life. But the root of those things is Satan himself. That's what the Bible's teaching us. And then there's abnormal demonic that we see especially highlighted in the Gospels, that sometimes people are attacked by demons. They have these manifestations of the demon within them. Whenever a demon sees Jesus, or somebody who's possessed by a demon sees Jesus, they normally cry out in response to him because the demons recognize who Jesus is. Crazy goings on, people being tormented by demons. In Acts, there's a girl that can tell people their fortunes because we're told she's demon-possessed. This demonic realm, it is a reality. It certainly is in the Bible. We have no reason to think why it's not necessarily today. But again, we need to have this balance that the Bible itself has to recognize that false teaching, things that aren't true, lies about God, just the everyday things that we see are demonic. People are rejecting Jesus. People aren't living their lives for God. people are in Satan's kingdom. That in and of itself is demonic. But also, we need to be aware of the fact that the demonic realm is still at work in our world, potentially in this way. We need to be sensitive towards that. We need to have great discernment and insight if we're going to be able to be effective in this day and age. This woman's little girl would fall into the category of abnormal demonic. She was being attacked by a demon in a specific way. We're not told exactly what was going on, but Jesus doesn't deny that this is a reality, that this girl is being attacked by a demon. And so she comes to Jesus for help. "Please help me," she says. What do you think the Christian response should be to somebody who comes and says, "Please help me"? If you, as a Christian, if somebody came and asked you for help, how do you think you'd respond? We probably think the best way to respond would be to say, "Yes, of course. I'm going to show God's love to you. I'll help you." But how does Jesus respond? Because his response is shocking, really, what he actually says. What does he say? He says, "It's not right to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs." What on earth is he talking about there? Well, the children are the Jews, God's chosen people who he's been working in for the past few thousand years and who the whole of the Old Testament revolves around, the Israelites who trace their descendants back to Abraham. Those are the children. Because the Jews believed that God's purposes and plans revolved around them. They were God's people. They were the children. Who are the dogs? The dogs are people that don't fit into the category of being a Jew. Non-Jews. Gentiles, as they're called in the Bible. So Jesus says, "You're not a Jew. This isn't for you. I don't have anything to offer you." What is Jesus doing here? Does he really mean it? Does he mean, "No, Gentile dog, stay away from me"? Is that what Jesus is really getting at? Did anybody see Benefit Street that was on the TV recently? I really like Benefit Street. It follows the lives of some people living in Birmingham on a street where the majority of people are out of work and on benefits. And there's a character called White D. She's called White D because she's white, and D because her name is D, as opposed to Black D, who also lives on the street. She gave herself that name, not me. She's kind of like the mother hen, and she's got a daughter, and her daughter's planning to go out to work, and she says to her daughter, "Why go out to work when you can just sit here and get free money?" Did White D really mean that when she said that remark? Some people actually took it the wrong way and thought, yeah, she really meant, "Don't get a job, you can get free money from the benefit system." I don't want to get into a debate about benefits, it's just an illustration, but White D, she didn't really mean what she said when she said that. I can see most of you didn't watch Benefit Street, so this probably isn't working as an illustration. But you see my point, that we can say something to kind of illustrate a point and disarm what's being said, the sentiment that's there. And that's kind of what Jesus is doing here. He's sort of highlighting the point that what he's just said, it isn't really true. She gets it, and she perseveres. She doesn't give up with this apparent pushback from Jesus. She says to Jesus, "Yes, I'm not a Jew, but there must be something for us." Just think about her response, this woman, compared to the Pharisees. Think about the amount of revelation that the Pharisees had compared to this woman. The Pharisees, they've been brought up with God's word. They're part of the people who have been at the center of God's working the past few thousand years. They've been taught the Bible. They had an amazing religious education. They had the Bible, and as much as it had been written to date, they knew it inside out. They had all the theology. They had all the religious trappings. They had all the understanding that anybody could ever have in that day and age. They had the best religious education that you could have. If it was all about what you knew, then there wouldn't be any people that were closer to God than the Pharisees. And yet, despite having that revelation, the foolish revelation at the time, really, that somebody could have, they're hard-hearted, they're stubborn, they're proud and arrogant and unloving, And they reject Jesus, who's the fullest revelation of God that there is. Now think about this woman. She's not a Jew. She's, we're told in Matthew, she's called a Canaanite. The Canaanites were one of the most ungodly people groups to ever be on the earth. They're notorious in the Old Testament. So she's coming from a heritage of very ungodly people, enemies of the Jews by tradition. She probably didn't know the Bible. She probably didn't have a great understanding other than what she just gleaned from the culture around her about who God was. But what does she do with the revelation that she does have? She comes to Jesus. She's humble. She asks Jesus for help. She knows that he is the answer. And in humility and in faith, trusting in Jesus, she comes and asks Jesus for help. Because it's not about how much revelation you have. It's about what you do with the revelation that you do have. It's possible to have a very full theological understanding. It's possible to have all the theology in the world. It's possible to be completely orthodoxed in your theology. It's possible to know the Bible inside out. It's possible to have had a Christian upbringing. It's possible to be in a church environment. It's possible to know everything that you could need to know about the Bible and be with Christians all the time, and yet be a million miles away from God. I'm not denigrating theology, of course, because we need to understand God so that we can love him better, serve him better. Of course, we need to grow in our understanding. But the Pharisees, they had all this understanding, and yet they were still in their hearts rejecting God. And everybody's on this sliding scale of revelation at some point. In Romans, Paul talks about the fact that everybody, it doesn't matter who they are, it doesn't matter what people group they come from, everybody has a certain amount of revelation. But the problem is, the default setting is that we're suppressing this revelation. So you might have somebody who's never heard the gospel, never heard about Jesus, never heard the Bible, but they do have revelation because they've got the creation around them. They have their conscience where they know that there is an objective right and wrong. They know in their conscience that there is a God, really. And yet they're suppressing and rejecting that. And at the same time, you have people at the other end of the scale who they've got all that revelation, but they've also had further revelation in that God has spoken to them through his word. And yet they still suppress that. They might know the gospel, they know about Jesus, and yet people are still suppressing that and pushing it down. Incidentally, one question that's often asked, I find is often asked, by Christians and non-Christians is, what happens to the person who's never heard about Jesus? Well, the person who's never heard about Jesus has a certain amount of revelation. They have enough revelation that if they really wanted to come to know God, they could pursue God at least. People are only held responsible for the amount of revelation that they do have, but any amount of revelation that we're given, be it a little or a lot, without God doing a work in our hearts, without God actually changing our hearts, the default setting is that we're always suppressing that revelation that we have. What if somebody who's never heard of Jesus, they stop suppressing the revelation that they do have? What if they realize that they have broken God's law? They know that there is a God. What if that person cries out, God be merciful to me, a sinner? What happens then? I'm not going to answer that question. I'll just leave that with you. But I want to encourage you tonight, because some people might be thinking, oh, I don't have a lot of theology. I don't have all the answers. I don't know the Bible inside out. The revelation that you do have to date, which can be added to because you have the Bible in English, very blessed. But the revelation that you do have is enough to come to Jesus. The revelation that you do have is enough to live for God. And God will give us further revelation, further understanding from his word, as we read his word, as we pray, as we get to know God better. But the revelation that we have in this moment, right now, is enough to be in communion with God. It's enough to come to know God. And those of you that are well-versed in the Bible, that do know theology, that do have a good understanding about what the Bible teaches, who know the scriptures. To whom much has been given, much is expected. The more we know of the Bible, the more obedience God expects of us. A lot of the time, this is true of me anyway, we can be educated way beyond our level of obedience. So we might know a certain amount about the Bible, but the obedience that we have to God's word doesn't balance with the amount of teaching that we've received. We're responsible for the amount of revelation that we do have. In Matthew's account of this story, we're told that Jesus marveled at her response. What she says in response, she says, "Even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." He marvels at that response. Jesus was probably thinking, these Pharisees, they should be the ones that are responding. They're the ones to whom the Messiah has been promised. They've got the promises of God, and yet they're rejecting me. And yet this woman, this Canaanite woman, she's the one that's coming to me and asking me for help. And she has better understanding than they do. What happens to the woman? She gets her request. She perseveres. She asks Jesus again. She doesn't give up. Jesus grants her request. And we should persevere as well in praying to God, in seeking God's face. Don't give up. Keep praying, keep persevering, because sometimes it's the process of the actual praying itself. God wants us to learn something through praying through something before he answers it. He doesn't just answer this woman immediately. Let's move on to verse 31. Jesus is on the move again. He goes to the Decapolis, meaning 10 cities. There was a region in Palestine where there were 10 cities, mainly occupied by Greeks. So again, a very Gentile area of Palestine, not full of Jews, highlighting again to us by Mark that it's not all about the Jews anymore. Jesus' reputation as a healer and a teacher and somebody that can cast out demons has preceded him, of course. Something amazing is happening, and everybody knew it. People were drawn to Jesus. When Jesus came to town, people wanted to find out where he was. They wanted to hear his teaching. Those who were sick wanted to be healed. Those who were demon-possessed, people wanted them to be freed from those demons. Imagine being unable to hear. Imagine being deaf. Imagine being deaf in the first century. Pretty awful, isn't it? And there's a guy that's brought to Jesus who has exactly that problem. He's in exactly that situation. He can't hear. And as a result, he can't speak properly either. Jesus heals the man, but I think this is quite a strange way that Jesus actually goes about it. He sticks his fingers in his ears and then spits and touches his tongue. Being a bit of a clean freak, just the idea of that in and of itself freaks me out a little bit. But that's what Jesus did. It's kind of as if he's almost using like a kind of sign language in the way that he heals the man to demonstrate to the man exactly what he's doing. And the guy can hear again and he can speak. It must have been amazing. We don't know whether this guy was deaf from birth or whether he became deaf later on in life. But either way, this must have been amazing. He can hear again. Again, another point of contention. Does God heal today? If somebody gets healed, does God heal today? Well, yes, because they got healed. Could somebody get healed today? Could God heal somebody? Yes. Should we be praying for people to be healed, to get better? Of course. Does everybody always get healed? No. Christians get sick, Christians die. But this guy gets healed. You'd expect Jesus to say to him, "Now that I've healed you, go and tell people about what's happened to you." That's what he does with the guy that he heals in Mark chapter 5. He says, "Now go and tell everybody what's happened to you. Go and tell your story." But to this guy, Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody. Keep quiet about it." Seems a bit strange. I'd expect Jesus to say, "Now go and tell everybody what's happened. you've been healed. The result of that is that you need to now go and tell people all about it. Why doesn't Jesus tell him to go and tell everybody what has happened to him? Sometimes we can think that the miracles, all they are, is just like little sermons that are showing us who Jesus is. So Jesus can heal, he has power over over sickness, because he's God. And that, of course, is true. But it's not just that. The healings aren't just a means to an end. The healings in and of themselves are important because Jesus actually cares about these people. The healing is an end in and of itself. Jesus actually really cared about this guy. He'd had a really tough life being deaf in the first century. And Jesus steps into his life and turns that completely around. Brings healing to him. And why? Because Jesus actually cares about this guy. He cared about the fact that he was suffering. He wanted to bring healing into his life. The healing in and of itself was important because it changed this man's life. And that's part of our mission and ministry as well. We're not just to think that as Christians, our mission is merely just to offer people safe passage into heaven, but and just swell the numbers of the church in whatever way we can. Of course, we're to be preaching the gospel. That's what we need to do. But it's not just that. It's not just about pointing people towards heaven. We have something to do while we're here. Now that we've been saved by God, we need to be bringing God's kingdom to earth in however we can, by being compassionate and caring towards people, just like Jesus is. Do we really care about people like Jesus does? He really cared about this person. Do we care about people as much as he does? I think we need to. I find it really hard to actually really care about people and love them, and not just be driven by a kind of sense of guilt, I should be telling this person the gospel, but to really look at a person and care about them. And because I care about them, to tell them the gospel, if they're suffering in some way, to see if I can help. We're not to just sort of look down on people who are suffering or going through a difficult time and say, if you're a Christian, then you'd be able to handle that suffering much, much better. No, if we can help people, we need to help them. If we can, if we're able to. Those of you that are in a caring profession, those of you that are in nursing, that's a really holy work that you're doing there. It's bringing God's common grace to all people. Of course, this did preach a message as well, though. It preached a message that God is bringing healing and restoration through Jesus, whether it be in this life, but ultimately, the final and full healing comes at the consummation when God brings in the new heavens and the new earth, and there's no more suffering, there's no more sickness, and there's no more death, and that's brought in by Jesus, his person and work. Let's move on to chapter 8. Jesus didn't have any problem drawing a crowd. We've seen that so far. We know that by now. He must have been an amazing teacher. People really wanted to come and listen to Jesus. There was something about Jesus. People wanted to listen to him. At this point, he's with a crowd and he's been with them for 3 days. And the food's run out. I don't know whether these people hadn't eaten for 3 days or whether they'd been eating for 3 days. And now their food had run out. But either way, there's no food. What does Jesus say? He calls his disciples to them and says, I have compassion on the crowd because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. I have compassion. See, again, Jesus actually cares about these people. He's been ministering to their spiritual needs, as it were. He's been teaching them about God's kingdom. But he cares about them as well. He cares about their physical needs. And Jesus, he's actually able to really sympathize with them because it's not as if he'd never been hungry. He's gone 40 days without eating in the wilderness, being tempted. 40 days with no food. But he doesn't just sort of stand aloof from them and say, you think 3 days is bad, try 40. No, Jesus is able to identify with them where they're at and have compassion on them. What does he do? It's similar to the miracle that he's done before with feeding 5,000 people. This time it's a little bit different. There's less people and there's more loaves, 7 loaves and a few fish. And he multiplies the loaves and the fish, and everybody is fed. But everybody's not just fed, like, you know, you've got enough, that will do the job. Everybody's fed, and they're satisfied. And there's leftovers as well. When Jesus feeds them, he doesn't just give them just enough. He really does feed them so that they're satisfied. God doesn't separate us into different categories of body, spirit, and soul, and say, I'll minister to your spiritual needs. But God treats us as whole people. Jesus treated these people as whole people and ministered to the whole. I think it's really important for us to have this understanding that there's not this kind of separation in people between the kind of their physical and spiritual needs, but to see people as a whole, minister to people as a whole. That's what Jesus did. I find this little passage particularly comforting because of my sensitive constitution when it comes to eating food. I'm hyperglycemic, self-diagnosed. You know, that's that thing that Gene Hackman has in Enemy of the State where he gets really grumpy when he doesn't eat. So I don't know where I'm going with this, by the way, but this passage just makes me think of that. But Jesus, he cares about us as a whole. He cares about our needs. He cares about these people. Again, do we care about people like Jesus does? Do we really care about people? Do we really look at people and have compassion on them like he does? I wish I did. We need to ask Jesus to change our hearts so that we care about people just like he does, just like God does, and for all people. So what Mark is highlighting to us, it's not just about the Jews anymore, that God is welcoming all people in. God is showing hospitality to all people through the gospel and saying now that everybody is welcome in. The woman, the Canaanite woman who is delivered, her daughter's delivered from the demonic realm, it's showing that everybody can be delivered from the realm of Satan, from Satan's kingdom through Jesus. The man who's healed is showing that everybody is welcome into God's kingdom, where eventually everybody will be healed and restored and made whole in Christ. Everybody is welcome in. The feeding of the 4,000 shows God's hospitality to us. He's welcoming everybody in, everybody, whether they're a Jew or not. Everybody's welcome to his kingdom and to that final feast, the marriage supper of the Lamb in heaven, which is actually going to be this world as it was supposed to be. Has anybody ever seen Bruce Almighty? You know, it's that film with Jim Carrey in it where Jim Carrey plays a guy called Bruce, and he becomes really disillusioned and angry because things aren't going in his life as he would have liked. So he gets really angry with God. And so God, played by Morgan Freeman, endows all his powers upon Bruce. And so he's Bruce Almighty. He now has all the powers of God. And what does he do with those powers? He's completely and utterly selfish with them, isn't he? Just like we would be if we had God's power. He uses his power to kind of get one over on his enemies. It's quite a funny scene. Just watch the film. But Jesus could have done the same thing, couldn't he? He could have, with the Pharisees, the whole kind of poo joke could have been taken to a right, you know, a complete other level. He could have actually made them defecate out of their nostrils. But he doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't use his power selfishly. He doesn't use his power to just draw attention to himself and say, look, I'm so great. His miracles are there to demonstrate who he is because he's God. But he uses his power to actually care for people, love people, because that's his heart, to care and love for people. That should be our heart as well.